session number 11212, reel 11.
Colonel R.B. Humphreys, reel 11. You're coming up to the end of your Khartoum service. What happened next?
Well, one of the notable things we did in Khartoum before I leave to tell you about, and that is all the officers went to a levee, which is, you know, for the king. Of course, it wasn't the king's birthday, I don't think, at the governor general's, which was the old site of where Gordon held out, overlooking the Nile. We sailed up in a launch, all in our full best bib and tucker, and we embarked on the steps, and the sight was wonderful. There were sheikhs coming in on their donkeys in their lovely dresses, and there were diplomatics and everything. And we had coffee and that sort of thing in the garden. But we did get enveloped quite often in Habub, a sandstorm, which was most unpleasant. Got in everywhere. Engine, the cars, everything. And very, very unpleasant indeed. And you saw them coming, pink, coming towards you. Nothing you could do about it.
And what was the drill if you were caught in a sandstorm?
Well, nothing you could do. I mean, the soldiers were in the bath. They got covered in sand. The bath got full of sand, swimming bath. If you were in your quarter, and it blew in, you got full of sand. And you just had to shut your mouth so you didn't eat the sand. There was nothing else you could do. It was just very, very unpleasant. But there weren't a terrific number when we were. And then there were times we went off trying to kill a rogue hippopotamus. And then I had, my friend and I had 6 weeks on right up to the borders of Abyssinia, shooting. Miles from anywhere. No, it was laid on by the district commissioner, Eastern Arab Corps, Eastern Province. And 400 miles, there was nobody. If you'd had an appendicitis or anything, you just had it. You had a. Shows the luxury in which you could do things. Well, the luxury, really, it was essential if you were going shooting. You were provided with. At a certain point, where we left Kuala Nakhl, where was the most wonderful old sheikh, who had been pro-Mahdi. And then Wingate went out. Not the Wingate, Sir Arthur, a very famous one, who was the Governor-General of Sudan. And he returned completely. And he had so many pictures of the queens and kings of England around his Queen Victoria, of course, because that was when Gordon was on, and Edward, round the guest house we stayed in, and he feted us with black coffee and everything. And next day we got a very old lorry which he'd produced, because sheikhs were pretty all powerful in that sort of area, and it was Kuala Nakhl. And we went about 50 miles, and there were, just at a certain spot, we had to do it by map and compass. We had cloth maps and a shikar, great big Arabs, and they've got slits down, you know, the thing. The man who was going to show us where the game was. There were eight camels, two riding camels for the Saabs, and six baggage camels. Each camel had a camel man. Then there was a policeman to protect us. If anything happened, I don't do much protecting. because we all got rifles. I mean, I had, and so the others got a... and then there was a cook. A very good cook, too. All natives. All produced by Gilder Evans, the district commissioner. And we just set off. And we did 10 miles perhaps one day. And we saw masses of game. And then we did something. Then we got down. It was orchard scrub, mimosa and that sort of thing. And we went up the Dinda and down the Rawhead. And we got within... Well, I actually walked into Abyssinia, and we got an old poacher on the Abyssinian borders. The old policeman caught him, but he came back with us, and he'd become an extra sort of camel man. And it was absolutely wonderful. We saw lion, and we saw leopard, and we saw buffalo, most dangerous animal in the thing. We saw masses and masses of different types of deer and antelope. And there we were, as I say, my friend Robert Allen and I joined with me, and if we'd had appendicitis or anything like that, there was no means of communication at all.
When this was over, did this bring you back to you leaving Khartoum? How about the time when you left Khartoum?
No, this was early on. This was early on, after I'd been there about a month. Three lots of pairs of officers went. Rupert Blackett went with Peter Luard. Reggie Atkinson went with... I don't think Peter Jeffries went with another chap. And I went, and we went for... staggered. We didn't meet each other on the way. The country is vast. And there were lovely... mares, as they call them, which was green because there was a terrific amount of rasama, Lake Rasama, every so often. But the riverbeds were dry. This is where you saw your game. All the game was on the mare. You used to see them wake up in the morning and see herds of buffaloes. It was 6 miles across. Herds of Tiang, herds of something else, herds of something else. And you would see the odd lion scooting about the place. We had a wonderful view, which we watched for a long time, of a lioness and our cubs playing at the bottom of the nullah. I mean, we were about only 40 yards from her. They didn't see us. She didn't want to anyhow. You don't shoot lionesses. In fact, the shooting rules were very, very, very strict indeed for sporting purposes. And that is why, of course, when we were protecting game rights in India and Sudan and places, there was no lack of game.
Can we move to the end of your cartoon?
Yes, then came the end. I was due for a home leave. I seem to have been on a lot of leaves, but I hadn't had a home leave. So I... and one or two others, but not the same time. Subalterns were sent home. I mean, Reggie, I think, overlapped and came out again before me. And Peter Luard, I think, had a home leave. And one or two others. Anyhow, I went on my own. About 3 weeks before the battalion left to go to China. 3 or 4 weeks.
This would be about October of 1937.
Yeah. And they left in November. And I started off the usual route for anybody going by train. Then I had to go by... cross by train and then river steamer, and past the temples of Abu Simbel, which hadn't been changed then, the temple of Philae, and of course you had to go across on Kitchener's line before you got to the river steamer, and then you embarked on the river steamer, and up you went, and into Egypt, and down into Egypt, where I caught a boat for Venice across the Mediterranean. I had an exciting time in Venice, dashing through in a gondola, having about 1 day or 2 days there. I did it all as cheap as I could, you know, it was steerage. And then across Europe in the middle of the night, where we had another exciting time, because in Switzerland, near the Simplon Pass, we ran over a little car. And I was sitting with about 3 others. There was a nice old French woman and 1 or 2 others. Suddenly the train jerked. And they looked out, and a little car had been stuck on a level crossing or something. This is in the middle of the night. And didn't hold us up for long. No one was killed. And then we arrived in Southampton. To have a leave until the end of February.
And you were there at home until February of 1938. How did you make your way back?
France. Continental, Canadian Pacific from Liverpool. By that time, of course, the coronation was over, and we heard that in Khartoum, and all the abdication and everything was over. So England was calming down again. But, of course, blowing up with Hitler doing all kinds of things. When I was at home, I think the next Austria, I can't remember, Dollfuss was killed. And
had you any feelings at this time that war was coming?
Everybody thought war was coming, I think. Everybody that was thought that war was inevitable. And then, of course, there was a sort of sigh of relief. I was back down in Shanghai when old Chamberlain waved his bit of paper amongst the ignorant like myself. But, of course, a lot of the politicians, Churchill, for instance, everything, knew that it wasn't going to be any good. The man was hell-bent, mad on conquering the world and doing away with the Jews and making an Aryan race. And that was.
Can we, before that, can we go to arriving in China and what conditions were there?
Yeah, a splendid journey across the Rockies. Skiing on the mountain for 1 day, Montreal, Great Divide, a game scene in the Rockies, the realm, the part moose and things, and down 1 day in Winnipeg where my nostrils froze, it was so cold, and views from the observation car across the prairies, which were deadly dull. Alberta and that sort of thing, and then the Rockies, and then down into Vancouver, where we had a day waiting for the next boat to come, which is the Empress of Russia. The Montcalm across the Atlantic had been a terrible voyage, and I'm as seasick as a pig, and there were only about 10 people standing for the 5 days. All the things in the lounge were tipped up, and it was one of the worst devices they've ever had. In fact, we were wondering whether we were ever going to get to Halifax, to Newfoundland. And, start off across the Pacific. Ticker tape breaking as we left, ticker tape being streamers. And Japan, 3 days. You could get off 3 days. We went to Yokohama, up in a taxi, terrifying drive in my life. Japanese driving like the hammers of hell at 60 miles. And no cameras, even those days. Usual things one did in Tokyo, went, had a meal at the most snazzy hotel and saw these lovely trees and very pretty country and pretty place. But the Japanese did not impress us. The Japanese were, they were cagey.
Did you get the feeling that there was a strong anti-British or anti-Western feeling against you in Japan?
Not particularly a strong anti-Western feeling. No. They weren't nasty at all. Then I had a day at Nagasaki, which I saw before. The great bomb, of course. And then up at Kyoto, I think, in the up country. It was lovely. And we got on the boat again and away we went, and we arrived in Shanghai on the Bund, where I disembarked and joined the 1st Battalion again, who had just settled down, and they were in a Chinese high school. Shanghai, the most cosmopolitan place you've ever seen in your life. Troops adored it. There we were, of course, because the Japanese-Chinese war, China war, was on and had passed over. The people we relieved, I think, were the Royal Irish Fusiliers. The people before that, Ulster Rifles, had one or two soldiers killed by Chinese and Japanese dogfighting over the British concession. We soon got into the swing of that. Everybody greeted us and everything. Famous Dalmite infantry who had been in the Shanghai Defense Force in 27, made such a name for themselves in everything.
Who was commanding the battalion out in China?
In China? GW. The 1st Battalion commander. You see, Jocaster was second.
GW. So, of course, this is the first.
But actually, yes. What happened was he was sick, because he was a sick man. He was a bachelor. He commanded Blackdown, he was sick. So Dad Hislop, second in command, who had come from Khartoum with us, he was second in command. He was a company commander in Khartoum under old Lysett, who had gone home. He'd gone home to some staff job and become a brevet lieutenant colonel and everything.
So who was the commanding officer? What was his name?
Major E.T. Heslop was acting commander for Lieutenant Colonel W.A. Gray Wilson, who didn't come out for a good 6 months.
So what was the role that the battalion was responsible for? What was their role in Shanghai?
Well, looking after our interests, our commercial interests. The Japanese, you see, although the war had passed over, they would have jumped on any commercial interests. They wanted to conquer China. That was them.
Was there any situations where there was a possibility of a clash between yourselves and the Japanese?
Oh, yes. Quite a number. And the other troops, too. The French had a complete force, and they had a part of the perimeter, the French concession. And the Americans had another part. And they were always trying to nip in. They were after trade rather than expansion. Well, first knocking China for a six. But they were being jolly nasty and very beastly. And they were beastly to the old peasants and things. And that was our role. We were there, and we had a major general called Telford Smollett. And the Americans had a major general, I've forgotten his name, and the French had a general in charge of their troops, and the Italians had a concession, although they'd been at war. I mean, they were there, and they had a sort of set of very wing commander Mazzioni. Was very they all made love a lot. They had wonderful uniforms, and their commander was a naval officer, and his wife, she was a beauty, and the French and ourselves and everybody, we all mixed, and we went to each other's clubs, and the soldiers enjoyed themselves because there was so much cosmopolitan anything to do in Shanghai. It was one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the whole of the world, and it wasn't really China. It was a cosmopolitan city on the borders of China. And the embassy had been moved to Nanking, where the Natural Hugesson was the ambassador. And the Yangtze, we always had riverboats. That was in the old days for our trade up the river, the Yangtze. Well, the Japanese sort of tried to, for our riverboats and other nationality riverboats, pinprick. And that was our main job, to guard our concession and to guard our waterworks, which was outside the concession. And they had in Japan, they had a Major General Pickett who was called Pagoto-san. He was worshipped by the Japanese, and he could see no wrong in the Japanese, and so General Telfus Moritz had him down to stay, and there was a special line hooked to show him atrocities. And the Colonel, Major Heslop, went out, and one day he had a pistol held to his chest by a Japanese officer on the perimeter. And one went to the perimeter for a week at a time with one's platoon. We had six posts along, and you had to report any ghastly things. And funnily enough, like all private soldiers, then the privates of the Japanese got on quite well on the railway line. I mean, one was standing there and one was standing there. But they saw these ghastly things, and they used to sort of almost hit the Japanese, stop them and report them straight away. And I got straight in hotline to headquarters down the road, and we were divided in two camps. Half the battalion was in Jessfield and half in Great Western Road. Two messes.
Did you yourself see any atrocities going on?
Mm-hmm.
Did you yourself see any atrocities going on?
Oh, messes.
What kind of things were they doing?
Old Chinese women would come in. You see, they brought things into the concession to sell with nothing but what you'd think was just a bit of grass. And they have sort of crosses, and they'd put them in the sun. They'd dump their grass, no Chinese men, and they'd keep them all day. But you couldn't go and cut them down, because otherwise you'd start an incident between your soldiers and their soldiers.
So they were crucified, in effect, was it?
Yeah, crucified.
Crucifixion.
And then in the evening, perhaps they cut them down. By that time, the poor old thing was half dead. If not, he couldn't carry his grass further in. And he lay there, and you sort of brought him to your side. And then he revived. And, oh, ghastly things. Going on the whole time. And the officers were the worst. They held the pistol to this very gallant Major's second in command. He was commanding the thing, and
Heslop.
Dad Heslop, yes, didn't bat an eyelid, and he dropped it in the end. He realised that he had shot. That would have caused a very, very major incident indeed. And the French were reporting the same sort of incidents coming in, and the Italians were, and the Americans were, and the all the other nationalities. And then the sort of main part of Shanghai was the Cathay Hotel, where Siegfried Sassoon, the famous, not Siegfried, Sassoon, enormous racehorse owner, lived at the top, and he owned the Cathay and all the... And then there was a race course, terrific race course, where he played polo frantically. We won a hell of a lot there. And there was nightlife, both for the soldiers and ourselves. We used to go and see a game called, it wasn't called Pelota, I forgot what it was called, High Lie. And you betted on it, and you sat and drank and looked, and all that kind of thing. The women sort of came around. A lot of, a terrific number of white women of officer class and others. A lot of them were white Russians, you know. They said they were white Russians. That's where the soldiers enjoyed it. They were white Russian princesses. And, of course, they'd come in the revolution. Poor things couldn't get back. They had no passports or anything. So they had to become whores or work in brothels and things like that. And some of them were very high-born. The man where we kept our ponies had been a full colonel in the Tsar's guard, a Krikoryants. And they had no passports. They couldn't do anything. And then, of course, the terrific number of traders like Jardine Matheson's, the Keswick brothers, and a lot of them lived outside and came through over the railway line in lovely houses, Honjiao. And before we got there, the bombing of... It had gone over Shanghai, the wall. And there was one notable bomb that dropped. There was Chinese pilots running away from Japanese being chased. And he dropped a bomb in the middle of the day at 12 o'clock on the junction of Avenue Joffre, which was part of the French concession where the road ran into the French concession, and our Nanking Road, I can't remember the name, I think it was Nanking Road, killed 1,000 people, over 1,000. And half of them were white businessmen, Chinese, rickshaws, scattered the whole lot. And that was the extent of the... There were more casualties caused out there, because, of course, the place was swarming in that war. And nobody knew about it at home. I mean, they knew about it, but they thought it was a sort of petty war, you see.
How long were you in China? Did you stay in Shanghai?
No, we went up to Tientsin.
And what was your role up there? What was the job up there?
Well, again, keeping the Japanese away from our concessions. Tientsin was a small... All our possessions in China were through trading, really. It wasn't like India, where you captured the country. You trade. And Hong Kong, of course, had been captured, and that was the centre of our British part of the trade. And Hong Kong was obviously the envy of Japanese because it was beautifully equipped with harbours and things. And Shanghai had lovely harbours. The flagship that sat very near the Cathay Hotel was called the Izumo. It had been the pride of the Tyne, and it was the flagship of the Japanese Navy. And they used to come offshore and all that kind of thing, into the other part, not into the concessions. And they didn't do it much because they didn't have a necessity to.
About what time did you move to Tientsin? About what date would it be? About what date did you move to Tientsin?
Tientsin about, before Christmas. We were there about a month before Christmas at least.
Which year was this?
1937. We were there, 37.
38.
But before that, in Shanghai, I was down at the waterworks guarding with my platoon, which was a very essential bit of the came down and he said, pack up within 48 hours, 24 hours, the war's going to start. And it was the time when Churchill had gone across and it looked absolutely inevitable that the war was going to start.
This would be Chamberlain.
Chamberlain. And next morning, much to my relief, he came down and said, stand down. You've got another 3 days down here guarding the waterworks. And it's not going to start after all.